Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program visits Colby College in Waterville for a talk by CNN Deputy Political Director Paul Steinhauser. He'll give an early read on the presidential campaign of 2012 and examine how new technology and social media affect the process in an address titled "The Next Race for the White House." If you enjoy this program and wish to hear it again, or perhaps to share it with a friend, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Sandy Mazel, director of the Goldfarb Center.
Good evening. I'm Sandy Mazel. I'm director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement, and it's my pleasure to welcome you tonight to what I think is going to be a very informative and important lecture here at Colby. Our guest this evening, Paul Steinhauser, is a 23-year veteran at CNN. I think it's the only job he's ever had. During the time that he has been at CNN, he has covered breaking news and specials and regular programming for the most important cable news network, for the last two decades. He served as the executive producer of Inside Politics and as a co-executive producer of CNN Newsstand. And for those of us who spend our afternoons watching CNN, he was instrumental in the launch of the highly successful program, The Situation Room, which many of us find indispensable to understand what's going on in the political world in Washington today. He also served as supervising producer for that show. In 2006, he was promoted to his current position as deputy political director and managing editor for politics of CNN. And in that role, he's been in a key position in news coverage of a number of live events, three of which: the election night coverage in 2006, the election night coverage in 2008, and the Democratic National Convention coverage in 2008, won Emmy Awards. Tonight, Paul is going to speak to us on how new technology is affecting the way we look at our political landscape. Please give a Colby College welcome to Paul Steinhauser.
Sandy, thank you very much. That was quite a nice welcome. I appreciate that. I guess that means I've been around a long time All right. I've been covering politics now full time since 2003 when I came up. 2003 when I came up to D.C. from Atlanta, and I got to say, so much has changed in the last 6 or 7 years. All the rules that we knew, that we followed, that the campaigns followed, have basically been thrown out the window. And why? Basically because of new technologies, social networks, YouTube. It's totally changed the way campaigns operate. It's totally changed the way we in the media cover the campaigns and how we cover news political events. I guess one of the most successful things for when you're running for political office is to be able to control the message. As a candidate, you want to be able to control what you're saying about yourself and how others perceive you. But in 2005, something called YouTube came around. And in the midterm elections of 2006, well, here's a good example of what happens when you don't control the message.
All right, friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas. And it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. And it's just great. We're going to places all over Virginia. And he's having it on film, and it's great to have you here. And you show it to your opponent because he's never been there and probably will never come. So it's good for you. Rather than living inside the Beltway, or his opponent actually right now is with a bunch of Hollywood movie moguls. We care about fact, not fiction.
All right, that's a little taste of that. I think you guys kind of remember that one. That guy was George Allen, and at the time he was a senator from Virginia, conservative Republican, pretty popular. And at the time he was running for re-election to the Senate, It was supposed to be a pretty safe seat. He was supposed to win pretty easily. But he had bigger things in mind. He was hoping that the 06 midterms would just be a tune-up for what he wanted, really, which was the White House in 2008. He wanted to be the Republican nominee. But that little incident kind of derailed his dreams for becoming President Allen. And it was something brand new. No, YouTube was about a year old at the time, a couple months more than that. And that video, which was shot by the person he called Macaca, who was working for his rival, a guy called Jim Webb, who is now Senator Webb of Virginia, Democrat. And that went viral. And it helped sink his campaign. It wasn't the only thing. I'm not going to blame it just on that alone. But it was the first taste that there was something out there called YouTube that immediately could steal the thunder and put a candidate in trouble with his own words, something that we'd never seen before, because until then, you had to get on the news, you had to do a commercial. This was instant. This was a kid with a camera, and it went viral, and millions saw it. Let's flash forward about a year later, and John McCain, we all remember John McCain. He's still around. He hasn't gone anywhere. But if you don't remember, before he became the nominee for the Republican Party in 2008, his campaign almost bottomed out in 2007. He was supposed to be the favorite. When it all started back in early 07, late 06, he was going to be the favorite for the Republican Party. But he ran into some trouble, and here is one of the reasons why he ran into some trouble.
It's well documented that we have, for quite a long time now, known where the real problem is in the Middle East. And, in fact, the president adequately described it as the axis of evil. I guess my question is, how many times do we have to prove that these people are blowing up people now, never mind if they get a nuclear weapon? When do we send them an airmail message to Tehran?
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan? Bomb, bomb, bomb. Anyway.
Most of you don't remember the Beach Boys, but that got John McCain in a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. And that thing went viral as well. And that was in the spring of 07. By the summer of 07, he was almost out. His campaign was this close to collapsing. He was able to turn it around, obviously. We all know that now. He won the nomination and didn't win the election, obviously. But that incident, plus another one where there was another crowd that McCain was at, and a woman in the crowd called Hillary Clinton a word that begins with B, and I think you know what it was. Those both went viral, and they put McCain in a very tough position. Take a look at this. This is interesting, too. Mitt Romney, he was running against McCain for the Republican nomination. Now, in 2007, when this came out, Mitt Romney had kind of changed his stance on some crucial social issues. But Mitt Romney, years earlier, had run for the Senate in Massachusetts, and here's what happened.
If abortion is morally wrong, aren't you responsible for discouraging it?
One of the great things about our nation, Sally, is that we're each entitled to have strong personal beliefs. And we encourage other people to do the same. But as a nation, we recognize the right of all people to believe as they want and not to impose our beliefs on other people. I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country. I have since the time that my mom took that position when she ran in 1970 as a U.S. Senate candidate. I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years,
that
we should sustain and support it. And I sustain and support that law and the right of a woman to make that choice. And my personal beliefs, like the personal beliefs of other people, should not be brought into a political campaign.
On the question of the choice issue,
by his opponents in the Republican presidential nomination, to say that Mitt Romney, when it comes to social issues, is a flip-flopper. And it put him in a very difficult position. And when you're running for the Republican presidential nomination on social issues, that's probably not what you want to be seen as. Let's talk about Fred Thompson. You remember him? He ran for the presidency, too. Didn't last very long. But this is almost ditto from Mitt Romney.
Mr. Thompson, do you support or oppose laws that prohibit abortions for convenience?
I do not believe that the federal government ought to be involved in that process. I think that we should not have federal funding for abortion. I think that states ought to be able to have reasonable controls over that in terms of parental notification. which I believe my opponent has opposed in times past. As far as notice requirements and things like that are concerned, I believe those are reasonable. I think when you get right down to the question that you pose, should the government come in and criminalize, let's say, a young girl and her parents and her doctor, which as aiders and abettors, that would be involved. I think not. I think that problem is going to ultimately be resolved.
Same thing. Fred Thompson going after the conservative vote in 2007. And that old video from his successful 1994 run for the Senate got a lot of play on YouTube, got picked up by the mainstream media, put him in a very tough position. Obviously, his campaign didn't last. And I'm not saying, again, that YouTube was the sole reason why some of these people and their campaigns failed, but it was a whole new dynamic and a very powerful dynamic. I've been picking on Republicans, and that's not fair. Let's pick on some Democrats. Let's pick on Joe Biden. Before he was vice president, he was a senator from Delaware, the gift for the gab, and he was running for the White House. I think you guys remember that. And he was back in his home, or he was talking about Delaware. And take a listen.
Manish, how are you, Manish?
Good to see you.
As you know, I got a lot of support from you, Senator.
That's where, and more to come, I think.
Yeah, so, no, I've had a great relationship. Right. In Delaware, the largest growth in population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. It's a fully, am I, I'm not joking. Oh, gigantic.
Yeah. As you can imagine, his campaign had to put out a statement pretty quickly to explain exactly what the senator was talking about. You got to behave yourself. If you're running for office nowadays, anybody and everybody's got a camera. Even if they don't have a camera, they've got a cell phone, and that's good enough. Everything you say, anything you say, can be and will be used against you by your opposition. It can be a 14-year-old debate, as you saw from Thompson and Romney, or it can be just a slip of the tongue. Joe Biden likes to have a good time, right? He was making a joke, but it wasn't a joke to a lot of people, and it got Joe Biden in some trouble. So it was a whole new dynamic for candidates in this last presidential election, something they weren't used to. YouTube didn't exist in 04. There were other ways to get things out, but not so quick and not so immediate and not so widespread. That said, it was a danger for a lot of candidates, and it changed the way they had a campaign. But there was also some good sides as well to new technology. You know, in the old days, if you were going to run for office, what would you do? You'd hold a news conference or an event, and you would announce you were running for president or running for Senate or Congress, and you'd have a big event, and the traditional media would come, the local TV stations, the newspapers. That changed in the last couple of years. In fact, some of the candidates, when they decided they were going to announce, they didn't announce on TV. They didn't announce at an event. What'd they do? They went to their website.
I announced today that I'm forming a presidential exploratory committee. I'm not just starting a campaign, though. I'm beginning a conversation with you, with America, because we all need to be part of the discussion if we're all going to be part of the solution. And all of us have to be part of the solution. Let's talk about how to bring the right end to the war in Iraq and to restore respect for America around the world. How to make us energy independent and free of foreign oil.
All right. Thank you, Hillary. Where'd she announce? On her website. Didn't hold a news conference. Didn't hold a big event. Kind of pissed me off. I was ready to send our top reporters out to cover this big event of Hillary Clinton running for the White House. We were all waiting for it. We knew it was going to come. But she decided to do it online. That video, a lot of people saw it on her website. More people saw it on YouTube. And, of course, then we picked it up in the mainstream media. But she did it on a Saturday morning, of all things. And it was a whole new world, something we weren't used to. And it changed the way we covered campaigns. It changed the ways that they ran their campaigns. About a year later, let's flash forward. A year later, it's 2008 now, and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are battling it out. These primaries went on and on and on. And do you remember that 3 a.m. ad that Hillary Clinton had? It was pretty effective. It talked about how Barack Obama wasn't experienced enough, and if it was 3 a.m. and there was a crisis at the White House, who would you want to have in the White House? And you'd want to have Hillary Clinton because she was much more experienced. That ad got some good airtime, and it got a lot of play in the media. But the Obama campaign was pretty quick to respond, and it only took a few hours for this to happen.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. but there's a phone ringing in the White House. Something's happening in the world. When that call gets answered, shouldn't the president be the one, the only one, who had judgment and courage to oppose the Iraq war from the start? Who understood the real threat to America was Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, not Iraq? Who led the effort to secure loose nuclear weapons around the globe? In a dangerous world, it's judgment that matters.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
They put out that ad within a few hours of the 3 a.m. ad by Hillary Clinton. It was their own version. It was their pushback against Hillary Clinton's ad. And sure, it was on traditional TV, but where did most people see it? YouTube. It got, I don't know, almost a million hits. It went viral, and it went viral instantly. And it was the Obama campaign's way. They were crafty. They were smart, and they knew how to push back and where to push back. So they put this ad out. They put it on traditional TV. You got to do that. But they also got it online, and their supporters pushed it. And it was instantly, within a few days, able to kind of put the Hillary Clinton ad, which was pretty impressive and pretty strong, kind of almost negated it in a way. And it was a whole new way to fight back. And the Obama campaign was very, very good at it. You know, what's interesting about YouTube is it's not just the campaigns and their opposition who are using the forum. It's anybody. User-generated content. Anybody can make a video nowadays and put it up, right? I'm sure some of you may have done that. Depends on how good it is, if it's going to go viral or not. But that's the whole idea here, is that the campaigns don't control the message sometimes anymore. Anybody can. And then campaigns have to react instantly. At the same time, it's a whole new avenue for them as well. And they now can use YouTube and other new social networks as a tool to get their message out, something they never had before. And it has truly, truly changed the way campaigning is done. It's also changed the way that we cover campaigns and we in the media put on events. Debates. Candidates have been having debates forever. Media has been holding debates. Well, we did something back in 2007, CNN, and it was something brand new. We teamed up with YouTube, and this is what happened.
My name is Jordan Williams, and I am a student at KU from Coffeyville, Kansas. This question is meant for Senator Obama and Senator Clinton. Whenever I read an editorial about one of you, the author never fails to mention the issue of race or gender, respectively. Either one is not authentically black enough, or the other is not satisfactorily feminine. How will you address these critics and their charges if one or both of you should end up on the Democratic ticket in 08?
Senator Obama, how do you address those who say you're not authentically black enough? Hey, well, not my question. Jordan's question.
You know, when I'm catching a cab in Manhattan in the past, I think I've given my credentials. But let me go to the broader issue here, and that is that race permeates our society. It is still a critical problem. But I do believe in the core decency of the American people. And I think they want to get beyond some of our racial divisions. Unfortunately, we've had a White House that hasn't invested in the kinds of steps that have to
be. All right, you got a taste there. Did you see that was Anderson Cooper in the back? He was the moderator of the debate, but he wasn't the star of the debate, neither were the candidates. The star of that debate was average Americans, you, me, anybody. We teamed up with YouTube, and you wouldn't imagine how many responses we got for questions. And it took a while to whittle them down. But it was a whole new idea, a whole new concept. And the questions didn't come from Anderson Cooper or from other journalists and reporters who cover political events. It came from average Americans. And the questions were different in a way. They were maybe more heartfelt and a little different than what the experts, the so-called experts, would ask. And I think because of that, the answers from the candidates were also a little more real. We did it again with the Republicans a couple months later in St. Petersburg in Florida. And it was the first time that anything like that had been tried. I would assume in the 2012 campaign you're going to see a lot more of that. Questions from you, me, everybody, not just from the experts. And it changed debates, and I think for the better. One last thing about YouTube, because we're talking way too much about YouTube, but that's okay, because it's really changed the way we cover news. Take a look at this. This was just a couple of weeks ago. Barack Obama decided to give a live interview from the White House, and who did he give it to? He didn't give it to any of the network anchors. Unfortunately, he didn't give it to any of my cohorts at colleagues at CNN. He gave it again to YouTube. Take a listen.
Hello, everyone. We're here at the White House today for a very unique event, an exclusive interview with President Obama, in which the questions come from American people who've submitted them and chosen them online. My name is Steve Grove, and I'm the head of news and politics at YouTube. Mr. President, thank you for taking time to answer these questions today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me, and thanks to YouTube for doing this. We had a chance to do this before I was elected and had a great time, so I'm glad we can do it again.
Great. Well, let's tell people a little bit about how this works. 5 days ago, as you were delivering your State of the Union address, we opened up our moderator platform on YouTube, where thousands of people have been submitting and voting on both video and text questions. Some of them, as you'll see, were hard-hitting. Others were emotional. Some were even funny. But all of the questions you'll see here today were voted into the top tier of the thousands of questions we received. And none of them have been chosen by the White House or seen by the president. So this should be a lot of fun. Mr. President, let's let Layman Marcus from Silver Spring, Maryland, kick us off. He submitted this video to remind us of where things were a year ago.
So let there be no doubt, healthcare reform cannot wait, it must not wait, and it will not wait another year.
Mr. Marcus writes, Mr. President, I know there have been political setbacks to getting health care reform done. The 40 million people who have no insurance can't wait. Will they be able to get insurance this year?
It is.
That's pretty cool. Could you imagine that a couple of years ago? Wouldn't have happened. But there's Mr. Marcus from Maryland who wants health care and he needs health care. And he got a question to the President of the United States. I couldn't imagine something like that 5 or 10 years ago. But that's the way it is right now, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that as we move forward. And YouTube, it's been around for, 5 years now? Something new is going to come around, something that maybe you will let even more Americans jump in and have more generated content from users. And it's going to continue to change. What it's done, though, is allowed Americans, citizens, average citizens, to become more involved in the political process. And I think that's a good thing. And it lets people, any person, any average person, maybe have a chance of getting a question to the President of the United States, which is pretty cool. Another thing about campaigns, we're talking about controlling the message. Another thing about campaigns that is incredibly important. If you want to win, you need money. Money is, it's everything sometimes. You need money to get on TV. You need money to do almost anything to campaign. So let's go back 10 years. That's a long time ago. Most of you were 8 or 9 years old, 10 years old maybe. And there was a guy called John McCain. Just talked about him before with his Bomb Around song. But in 2000, in 1999, 2000, in that presidential election, John McCain did something that nobody else had really done before. He used the internet to raise money, which was revolutionary at the time. And he did pretty well. He didn't beat George Bush in the primaries, but as an insurgent Republican candidate in 2000, he got pretty far. And his ideas were, in a way, revolutionary. Let's go ahead 3 years. There was a guy called Howard Dean. You remember Howard Dean? Howard Dean did something pretty cool in 2003. He raised about $40 million online, which was truly astronomical at the time. That was just incredible. And meetup.com and moveon.org were two ways that he did it. He used the internet to reach out, to build up a database of people, of supporters, and he was able to pour in the money. And for a while, in the fall of 2003, up until about January 2004, he was actually the front runner in the Democratic presidential nomination. That didn't work out so well. He lost Iowa. He screamed, and it was all downhill from there. But he made some history. And there were some guys, some Democratic operatives who were watching him and keeping an eye on him. And a lot of those guys and ladies ended up working for Barack Obama. And they learned from Howard Dean. And they took what Howard Dean did, and they kind of amplified it by about 100 times in 2006, 7, and 8. And Barack Obama, his campaign was incredibly successful. Facebook pages, MySpace pages, he built up a support across the country that we had never seen before. And he raised money online, broke every record, shattered them by far. And it was interesting because we all thought Hillary Clinton at the time was going to be very formidable. And she was. I mean, that fight went a long time. But we thought Hillary Clinton was going to be the queen of fundraising, that Barack Obama didn't have a prayer. He wasn't going to be able to keep up with her. She was going to raise so much money because of her husband and because of all her connections. And she was the traditional Democratic candidate. But Barack Obama, mainly because of the support he got through the internet, he was able to raise a boatload of money, even more than her in the end. And in the end, he won the nomination. And one of the reasons why was Facebook, MySpace. It brought people to his campaign like we had never seen before. And in the end, he not only beat Hillary Clinton, he also beat the Republicans, and now today he's in the White House. What works well for one side works well for the other. Republicans, they didn't do so well in the 2008 campaign, did they, in the elections? But they learned from their mistakes, I guess. And they have been incredibly smart and successful since then. I covered in 2009, right after the election was over, we covered the Republican National Committee. They were having an election for their chairmanship, which, as you know, Michael Steele, you've heard of Michael Steele, he won the election. But a bunch of the candidates who were running, including Steele, one of the things they emphasized as they were making their bids for the chairmanship was to use social media, to reach out on Facebook, on MySpace, elsewhere, and to reach out to Americans to make up for the lost ground that the Democrats had captured. And to a degree, they've been pretty successful over the last year. Republicans are getting very, very savvy. They've learned the Democrats' tricks, and they're using them just as successfully. How about Sarah Palin? She retired. She stepped down from the governorship in Alaska last summer. How did she get her message out after that? She wasn't governor anymore. She didn't have the bully pulpit in Alaska. Facebook. She would make news on her Facebook page. And we caught up with that. We figured it out. And I have a guy who basically every day he comes in, he looks at her Facebook page 4 or 5 times a day. It's one of his jobs. And if she makes news, we're going to find out about it where. Not because she's put out a press release, because she's making news on her Facebook page. And she's been very successful with that. Could you imagine that a couple of years ago? Facebook really didn't even exist. And it's just a whole new dynamic for them and for us. How about the last three elections? We've had three statewide elections in the last couple months. We had the two governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia, and we just had that Senate election, as you remember, in Massachusetts. The Republicans won all three elections. And part of that, of course, is the political climate right now. But here's an interesting fact. The three winning candidates had more fans on their Facebook pages than the three losing candidates. It's not the only reason they won, but the Republicans are catching up. And have caught up. They figured it out, that social networking is crucial to their campaigns. A year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, Twitter really was nothing. It was pretty small. But now Twitter has become a huge part of our lives. How many of people here tweet? Most people, though, how many of you are on Facebook right now and use it every day? That's what I thought. That's good. Twitter's catching up. I think more of you are going to be doing it sooner or later, but the campaigns have figured it out. And now candidates, they'll put out a statement, or 140 characters, and they'll tweet it first. Sandy and I were just talking about this in our dinner a couple minutes ago. The president the other day, was it yesterday or 2 days ago, had that event at the White House where he laid out what he wanted to do with healthcare, and he had a bunch of doctors all in white, you know, medical suits. And almost instantly, 5 to 10 minutes into that live event, which all the cable networks carried, Congressman Price of Georgia, Republican conservative, tweeted, and he was lamenting that this was just another staged event at the White House, another photo opportunity. And how did he get that out? He didn't even send out an email. He did it on Twitter. They're getting savvy. They're getting very savvy about getting their message out and getting it out quickly. And those of us in the media who cover this stuff, we do that. One of the first things I do in the morning now, besides checking Facebook, is I light up my tweet deck, where I get all the tweets from a lot of the campaigns, from a lot of the candidates, from a lot of the Democratic and Republican operatives, and it's just another avenue now to get out the news, to get out your message. Check this out. I think it's right here. Let's see. There we go. Tea Party. You've heard a lot about the Tea Party. I've been covering the Tea Party for, since July. I didn't cover the first one last April, but I've been covering almost every one of them since July. I was down at the convention in Nashville. This is interesting. Look at this. This is the Tea Party Express. Those are the guys that did the – remember that cross-country caravan last summer that ended up in Washington on September 12th, that huge rally in Washington? They did another one, and now they're going to – they're about to do a third one now. And here they are bragging about their fans flocking to Facebook. This is how they reach out, and this is how they've been extremely successful. The Tea Party activists have been extremely successful – in getting their message out and building their the size of their movement. How? Partially by Facebook. And this is how they communicate with each other. And it was a tool that did not exist a few years ago, but now they are using it and using it quite well, not only to raise money, but also to get their message out, to build their support. And in this case, they've got another cross-country caravan that's about to start later this month. It's going to start in Nevada, actually. They're going after Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader. They're going to have Sarah Palin in Searchlight, Nevada, which is Harry Reid's hometown. And they're building up their support and acknowledgement, and they're putting out the word through Facebook. In Massachusetts, we were talking about that election, that Senate election. Scott Brown, a state senator who nobody gave a prayer to. Nobody thought this guy was going to win this election. We in the main, I mean, I remember even in early December after he won the primary, I'm not saying we coronated the Democratic candidate, but we really did not think that the Republican candidate was going to have much of a chance. And then all of a sudden he started gathering steam in late December and in early January, and he started raising a boatload of money. And one of the ways he was raising that money, local Tea Party groups in Massachusetts, not even national ones like right here, the Tea Party Express, but local chapters across Massachusetts started reaching out through Facebook, through Twitter, and they helped raise a lot of money for Scott Brown. He was able to use that money to pump it in, buy commercial time, flooded the airwaves. I'm not saying that's the only reason he won, but it definitely helped him win that election and pull off one of the biggest political upsets in a long, long time. And the Tea Party, they could take some of the credit for it because they definitely were able to generate support, enthusiasm, and energy. Let's flip around now. Just in the last couple of weeks, have you heard of the Coffee Party? Have you got anybody heard of them? There you go. This is something brand new. I didn't even know about it until about 2 weeks ago. It started about 6 weeks ago, and I just interviewed the woman who kind of founded the movement. And I guess you could consider them maybe a progressive or liberal equivalent of the Tea Party, or trying to be. Let's see. It's way too early to see how serious or large this movement will grow. But it was a woman in the D.C. area who was a little sick of the mainstream media, of me and the rest of my types, from giving so much coverage to the Tea Party movement. And she was frustrated. So what'd she do? She talked about it on Facebook. She reached out to her friends. And she said, you know what? Instantly, I started getting responses. And she got flooded with them. And then she started a fan page. And then she got more and more. And all of a sudden, she got coverage. And you know what? Right now, she has 60, as of the other day, she has 68,000 fans on Facebook. And in 2 weeks, or actually a week from Saturday, there are going to be coffee parties across the country, L.A., Houston, Dallas, D.C., New York, maybe even in Boston and a few other areas. And it all started online. And this is something that couldn't have happened a couple of years ago. It just the technology wasn't there to allow people, somebody who's frustrated, somebody who's pissed off, to start a movement. And again, this is too early to say if the coffee party is going to become a real movement in the Tea Party mode of things. Let's give it a little time. But still, it's just another example of how one person, just one person, Annabelle Park is her name, in the Washington, D.C. area, can really change the face of politics. It's truly, truly remarkable. And this is just the beginning. I mean, a couple of years ago, we didn't have MySpace or Facebook or YouTube, the three examples I've been using. A couple of years from now, we're going to have a lot more. And it's going to make user-generated content, and it's going to make people, it's going to give the ability for people to reach out and make a difference all easier. And to me, this is a good thing, because the more people are excited about democracy, regardless of their philosophy, whether they're conservative or liberal or whatever, whether they like big government or hate big government, whether they're in favor of the healthcare reforms the president is pushing or against them, it gets people excited and involved in democracy. And that is a good thing for this country. So It's just a little taste of what has changed over the last 5 to 6 years. Politics, as I knew it, as your parents knew it, it's gone. It's changed forever, and it's going to change again. And that's pretty much what I came here to talk about tonight.
Paul, thank you. And will you handle questions yourself, or do you want me to handle questions?
However you want to work it.
You do call on them.
We can do it together, whatever you want.
No, I want you. All you. The floor is yours.
Well, yeah, we can. And listen, we don't have to talk just about MySpace or Facebook or YouTube. We can talk about anything, including the midterm elections, which are coming up, the race for the White House, which is underway, even though they won't admit it. These people are running for the White House. So go for it. I'm here to talk.
Hi. Now that all these political people have Facebook and Twitter, are you not worried for your job? We can just go straight to the source. Why do we need CNN?
It's a great question. You can go right to the source, but can you trust the source sometimes? I guess there still is a use for the mainstream media because we consider ourselves journalists, reporters, and we report on what is happening. So, yeah, you can go right to the source. You can read anything you want online, but can you trust it? I mean, anybody can start a blog. Anybody can say whatever they want online, but is it factual? So what we do, we still think serves a purpose. We try to get the truth in what's going on.
Let's take that a step further. It was Mark Twain who said, a lie is halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. It seems today a lie is all the way around the world before the truth even gets its boots on. I mean, take the birther movement, for example. How one person can start some positive valence kind of organization, it seems to me that one person can start a rumor, can tell a lie that other people pick up, and it takes on a life of its own that's immune to any conventional kind of media or certainly to a response on online. And the corrosive effects of this on our politics, it seems to me, are quite something we should be concerned about.
Well, you're absolutely right. The speed nowadays is incredible. Things are so fast, and the news cycle is so fast. But you're right. Something can spread like wildfire online and go viral very quickly. But I wouldn't say it's immune to the main. I mean, if something goes viral and becomes that important, obviously we're going to cover it. And when we cover it, we're not just going to take it at face value. We're going to question what has been said and try to get the truth, get the facts. So, yes, something can spread immediately, and people can believe it. But at the same time, our job in the media, in the mainstream media, is to cover the event and try to figure out what's right, what's wrong, what's real, what's not real. And in a way, our job has become much harder, easier and harder, because there are so many outlets for news to happen now. It can happen anywhere. It can happen on any medium. And for us, we have to follow so much more now. In the old days, when people were covering politics, you'd reach out to the campaigns, you'd read their press releases, and talk to a couple analysts, and that was pretty much it. But now, anybody can jump on online anywhere and can change the face of a campaign. So you have to keep your eyes on so many different things. On a daily basis, I'm reading my Outlook emails. I'm getting emails from the campaigns, but I'm also looking at Facebook. I'm looking at Twitter. I'm reading the blogs, and it's overwhelming at sometimes. But too bad. I mean, that's our job. Our job is to sift through all this. So I'm not crying or anything at all. There's actually more information out there now than there's ever been before, and that's a good thing. Sure, it's very time-consuming, and it's tough sometimes to keep track of it all, but there is more information flow than ever before.
You've talked a lot about how candidates themselves have been using new sorts of media, you know, to get their message out, and et cetera. Have the parties been using the media to do similar things, you know, independent of candidates?
I'm sorry, candidates not with Republican or Democratic Party, you mean independents?
No, just the parties themselves, like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. What have they been doing similar things?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, let's take the Democratic Party, for example. After the 2008 election was over, the Obama campaign didn't exist anymore, but it morphed into something called Organizing for America, which is now part of the Democratic National Committee. It's part of the party. And basically the campaign structure and their incredibly large email distribution list went over there, and they reach out to their supporters across the country to try to push things, to try to help the president pass his agenda. They do it by email, but they also do it using the social media as well, from Facebook to Twitter and other things. One of the big question marks, we were wondering how successful they would be, because the Obama campaign was incredibly successful. I think even Republicans will admit to that. And we were wondering how successful Organizing for America would be last year and even in this year in helping the president pass his agenda. And I think some people are actually a little disappointed by that because, well, I mean, you've seen the president struggle trying to pass some of his major, you know, legislation. It's different sometimes when there's not an actual campaign out there. It seems it's a little more difficult sometimes to motivate people. You know, people who were excited because they hated George Bush and wanted to vote Barack Obama president, well, maybe they're not as excited about passing health care reform and climate change. And the enthusiasm isn't there as much as it was during the campaign season. So sometimes what works in a general election campaign doesn't work when you're trying to pass legislation. But yes, the parties are pretty successful. The parties all have Twitter pages. They all have Facebook pages. Everybody nowadays, if you want to be successful and savvy, you need to be using social media. Way in the back. Microphone is way back there. You're going to be in great shape by the time the night is over.
I was just curious how this compares to international politics and if in Europe we're seeing similar things throughout the world and how that compares to the U.S.
That is a great question, which I am totally unprepared to answer because I'm just overwhelmed covering domestic politics. So I would assume that what we're seeing in this country, we're also seeing in a lot of other democracies. I know Great Britain, I think the British have an election coming up, and maybe we're seeing similar things over there. And here's another thing, and I have no idea. The Iraqis are having an election in a week or two, and I would be fascinated to know if, and Ms. Sandy, I don't know if you or anybody else knows, I don't know if they're using the social networks as successfully as we are. So I wish I could answer, but I have not a clue. You stumped me on that one.
I can actually kind of attest to that. Thank you, Jen Yoder. I don't know if she's here. But in the recent German election in the fall, a new party emerged called the Pirate Party. And it was an online party that basically looked to steal the votes from all the mainstream parties. And in a pluralist system like Germany has, it has a large effect on the outcome of an election. And do you see like anything like that ever possibly happening? I know because of the two-party system that exists, it would definitely be tougher, but could that be an outcome of this new trend?
Oh, it could be. And there's been a lot of talk over the last 6 to 9 months about the Tea Party. We were just talking about the Tea Party, and there's a big question mark out there. Is the Tea Party, do they want to form a third party, or do they just want to kind of change the Republican Party and make it more conservative? And that has been a big topic of debate, and most of the Tea Party leaders say no, they don't want a third party. But some independents have been very successful in this country. It's not easy, especially on the presidential level. But, you know, we have seen some successful third-party candidates. And it's easier for them now than it was a couple years ago because of social media. It makes it easier to get rid of the party structure or to beat the party structure, which is not so easy. The parties are very powerful, and they've got a lot of control. But the use of social media, of new technologies, can make it easier, I think, for an independent, a third-party candidate to be more successful now than they were in years past.
Paul, I'm interested in the answer you gave on Organizing for America and whether, in fact, the news media in its alacrity to cover this new technology and all these very exciting things that are going on isn't missing what I think is, in fact, maybe the bigger story. Organizing for America has been a bust as a governing tool. I get my email every single morning. Sometimes, too, I know because my name is L. Sandy Mays, and they all come Dear L. So I know exactly what mailing list it comes off of. And I think one of the lessons from the Tea Party, one of the lessons from Howard Dean's campaign, one of the lessons from John McCain's campaign in 2000, was it's very easy using social network to be the critic, to fire up those people who are have something to be unhappy about and are willing to express their unhappiness. It is very difficult to govern with those situations. And it seems to me the press, with all due respect, has not in fact covered the difficulty that these ways of everybody giving information and expressing it have caused in getting government work of government done at the national level or at the state level around the country.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's always easier to be out of office and being critical of what's going on than actually governing. It also motivates more people. I think to a degree, the supporters who helped elect Barack Obama president are a little disillusioned right now. They thought they won a great victory in 2008, and they've seen the frustration and shared the frustration of the White House and the Democrats in Congress of trying to pass any legislation. They've had some victories in 2009, but some of their larger things they've wanted to pass, healthcare reform, climate change, are still...
But isn't it the point that Obama in 2008 was the against candidate? He wanted, as Sarah Palin so famously said, that hopey changey thing. And as soon as he came in to govern, the difficulty, which riling all the people up and getting them excited about change, dealing with separation of powers, God forbid, in a system of federalism in which we have to make compromises and negotiate through differences in order to get policy passed, leads to disappointment for all those exact same people. And if the Tea Partiers came in, they'd be disappointed too, just as I think the Democrats have been.
You're absolutely right. That's why you're the professor. There was a level of expectation that the Democrats and the president were going to get a lot of things done. They had a very large majority in Congress, and they had the White House. And there was a hope and actually an expectation that a lot of things were going to happen, and a lot of things so far have not happened. And there is definitely a level of disappointment. At the same time, there's always an anti-Washington. Nobody likes Washington. I mean, I like living there, but most Americans don't like Washington. They don't think that Congress and lawmakers and the White House are responsive to their needs. And there was plenty of that in 2008, as you mentioned. Exactly. Barack Obama was running against Washington in 2008. Now Barack Obama is Washington, and the Democrats control Washington. And there is still that anti-Washington mood out there. It was working in favor of Barack Obama and the Democrats in 2008. And now it is working very much against the Democrats in 2010 as they try to defend their majorities in Congress. And it's going to, as of now, it is working to the benefits of the Republicans. And that's what makes this midterm election so exciting. Can you imagine a year ago, early, January, February last year, March, that we would even be considering the idea that the Republicans were going to take back Congress? I mean, you'd be laughing at me. And now it's a very real possibility. There has been such a change in the last year. And what's incredible is that, in 2006, when you saw that same feeling and you saw what happened, the Democrats won back Congress. But at that time, the Republicans had been controlling Congress for about 10 to 12 years, and the president was well into his second term. It took a while. This is quick. The Democrats have controlled Congress for 3 years now. And this president has been in the White House for, 14, 15 months? It's just how quick it has been is just mind-boggling to me.
I'm going to...
You've got the mic. You control the mic. You
can... switching gears a little bit and maybe moving away from social media as well, I want to talk a little bit about digital media as a whole. The New York Times, CNN, Fox, MSNBC... The Wall Street Journal, all have websites, and I can get up in the morning and check every single source, and by the time I get my hands on a newspaper or turn on the TV, there's no more news. There's nothing new and interesting to read or hear on TV. What do you at CNN and publishers or people in charge at the New York Times need to do to make sure that the digital media doesn't kill the newspaper?
Well, that's a great question. And the internet has changed everything. I mean, 10, 12 years ago, well, a little more than that, maybe 14, 15 years ago, if you wanted to get news and you wanted to get headlines, where would you go? You had to go to CNN or MSNBC or Fox. You wouldn't go online. And as you said now, you wake up, you get everything you want online or on your BlackBerry or on your iPhone. And it's put television, cable news, in a very difficult way. And I'll speak more about that rather than the newspapers, but because that's where I work. It's changed how CNN and the other networks put their newscast together. And it's not headlines and hard news anymore. You've got to give viewers more than that because they've already got the headlines. So, you know, there has to be opinion now, and there is a lot of opinion in some of these networks, and there's got to be, you've got to dig deeper, as Anderson Cooper always says. He was always digging deeper. But there's a reason for that, because you've already read the headlines online, so if you're going to watch AC360 at 10 o'clock at night, you're not doing it just to find out how many are dead in the Chilean earthquake, because you already know that. So what they do, what we do now, is try to dig deeper, and we try to give you something that you haven't already read online. And the newspapers, to a degree, are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to give you more feature. And I don't mean, you know, feature being something light. They're trying to give you something beyond the headline, something that you haven't already read online. Because if they don't, there's no reason for you to go there anymore. But the thing about it is also, the newspapers and to CNN, we all have websites now. And for me, it's dramatically changed what I do. It used to be a couple years ago, I run the political unit day by day, and most of our product, most of our news back in the 2004 campaign went to the TV side. A little of it went online, but most of it went to the TV side. Now it's just the opposite. Most of what I do and most of my product and our political unit's product today goes online, not on TV. Sure, we still are on TV. We provide the TV plenty of material, but most of our product now goes online, and it's dramatically changed how I work, how I run my day, and where my news goes.
So the worry I've always had about social media, and I think it relates to Sandy's astute observation about the way they work, is that they bring like-minded people together very effectively, and so that you get this sort of echo chamber where everybody becomes more extreme in whatever direction they are. Has this sort of observation about the social networks changed the way CNN operates? I mean, do you see yourself as trying to be the last place in America where not everybody of the same mind is gathering?
Well, we'd like to consider ourselves the independent network. Yeah. I mean, our job is to tap into what's going on the social networks and to report on them, but we report on both sides. We report on the Tea Party. We report on the Coffee Party. We try to give a little taste of everything. We still consider ourselves a news network. I think there's a perception by some people that Fox News tends to be more conservative, and there's a perception that MSNBC tends to be more progressive or liberal in their coverage and in their analysis. And CNN, we try to pride ourselves on trying to play it down the middle, trying to play it straight, and being the independent network. But you make a very good point on the social media. It brings like-minded people together in a way, which is natural, because if you're out there and you have some firm beliefs, you want to reach out to others who have those same beliefs. For a lot of different reasons. And social networking now allows you to do that extremely easy and extremely quickly.
The social media, I think, provides somewhat of a competition for the mainstream media. So don't you think that kind of pressures the mainstream media to cover short, eye-catching things rather than in-depth informative information? And don't you think that hurts American democracy to some degree?
Wow, that's a good question. Let me think about that one for a second, considering this is probably being recorded. Well, I'll say one thing about eye-popping. Of course, you turn on any newscast, be it a local newscast or a network newscast or cable, and of course you're going to see some of those eye-popping stories out there. And there's a reason they're on television, because we're just like anything else, we're a business and we need to turn a profit and we need to have viewers. So yes, there's always going to be a mix of stories. What's important, what you need to know, the spinach, the vegetables, which we feed you, but also the fun stuff, the dessert that, you know, newscasts, news directors hope bring in viewers. So there's always a mixture of the two. That was there before the social media were there. I don't know if that has changed the mix. I'd like to think that we still cover the meaty stories and cover them well, at least at CNN. Why? Not because we're looking for viewers, but because it's important. Healthcare coverage, not the sexiest thing in the world. It's not going to grab viewers, but it is an extremely important issue that affects every one of us, all of you, all of your parents. And why do we cover it? Again, not because it's going to bring in viewers. Breaking down a healthcare bill is probably the most boring thing in the world, but it's extremely important, and we do it because it is important. So I think to a degree, social networking has affected our news content, but I don't think we've actually, because of that, skimped when it comes to reporting on what's important. Something easier than that. That was tough. Come on. Give me an easy one at the end. Way in the back. Well, there's two over there.
It seems to me that the public can't let anything go, at, like McCain's Bomb Iran song. And I feel like that was sort of like a comic relief. And so why is it that you think that people can't let things go? And also, do you think that if politicians were allowed to speak on their own rather than being teleprompted, do you think that things like that would happen more often?
Well, plenty of politicians don't use teleprompters. They speak on their own. They speak off the cuff, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes that gets them in trouble. I mean, you saw that clip of Joe Biden, Senator Biden at the time. That was definitely not on teleprompter. No doubt about it. As for the American public and why they can't let things go, I can't answer that. I don't know. Sandy, did you have an... help me out on that one.
I've got some theories, but I'm not sure I'm going to... any more that they're being recorded than you are. One more question back over here.
Okay.
Mine's just about the 2012 election. What do you think the media is going to have effect on the influx of number of candidates in the primaries?
In the 2012 presidential primaries, what impact we're going to have?
What impact do you think like the new forms of media will have in the number of candidates for the primaries?
Well,
do you think it will increase or decrease?
Yeah, you would think that it allows anybody to jump into the game, but whether you're going to see a larger pool of candidates in the Republican presidential nomination because of new media, I don't know if it's going to affect that. I mean, we're right now keeping our eyes on about 10 to 12 Republicans who may run for the White House. You know, at this early stage, even if you are going to run for the White House, you don't announce it. Nobody's going to announce it this early. But people are starting to make waves. They're writing books. They're going on TV shows. They're campaigning for other Republicans. They're raising money through their PACs. It's part of the game. It's part of the pregame season that we're in right now. And once the midterm elections are over, then they're going to start coming out of the pregame season and starting to actually run for the White House. Whether there are going to be more Republican candidates because of the growth of social media, I don't know if that's going to impact. I think there's probably going to be a number of them anyway. Right now, the Republican Party there's no one leader. That's always the case with the party out of power. So I think there are a lot of Republicans out there right now who feel pretty good about things. A lot's changed in a year, and I think you see the public opinion polls. The president's approval rating is below 50%. You see the Democrats having a tough time right now. It's a very tough anti-incumbent climate, which hurts the Democrats more than the Republicans. There are more Democratic incumbents. And I think that is exciting, or at least giving some Republicans who probably had no thought of running for the White House some thought now, because there's a better chance now for them than there was a year ago. I think that may have, actually, the political climate may have a more of an impact in making the field a little larger than the use of or the growth of social media. But we will see, and that is one of the most. I love covering the midterms. The midterms are great, but I think the most fun I ever have is covering the big one, and the big one is always the race for the White House. And this next one is going to be very interesting, a lot more than anybody had imagined about 6 or 9 months ago. I think this race is going to be pretty competitive, and I think you guys are going to be very interested.
Paul, thank you very much.
You've been listening to CNN Deputy Political Director Paul Steinhauser on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.